each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from a little cave on a tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened and a vision was revealed. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing in the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it has always been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let us now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, and author of A Mother's Plea for the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hello, my name is Sister Helena Burns from the Daughters of St. Paul, and I'm filling in for Father Anthony Bush, and you're listening to listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And our topic today is going to be women, one of my favorite subjects. We're going to talk about theology of the body and women, the feminine genius, and we want to take a look at the so-called war on women. We want to talk about the feminist movement and the sexual revolution. Were these good for women or not? Why are women so depressed today? What is the good news for women and about women today? And we want to talk a lot about solutions. We know there are so many problems, but we really want to focus on the positive and the solutions that we have. And I have some wonderful call-in guests lined up for you, so please stay with us. I'd like to begin by talking about this thing called the feminine genius. And Pope John Paul II is the one who actually coined this phrase, not in his Theology of the Body, but in his On the Dignity and Vocation of Women. And women got so excited, we were like, yay, feminine genius. And then we said, what is it? The feminine genius is the way God created us, body and soul. We are a unit as a human person, body and soul. So a lot of times what we do is we just look at our spiritual nature, our spiritual side, and we say, well, this is the way I am as a woman or a man. And we kind of almost ignore the physical, almost ignore our bodies, or we impose on our bodies. We say, well, I can overcome my body. I'm not going to listen to my body. I'm not going to listen to my cycles. I'm just going to make them do what I want them to do. And this is not the feminine genius. This is not the way God created us to be. We need to be very attentive to our physical and spiritual nature, both. And it's a beautiful thing, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of patience to do this. But when we live in accord with our true nature, that's what brings happiness. The ancients used to define happiness as living in accord with our purpose, with our true nature. And it takes time to get to know what that true nature is. So a lot of times we like to make fun of the male and female differences. It's often the topic of a lot of movies. It feeds into sitcoms, etc. And sometimes the feminine genius can be very funny, too. We have many hormone strands, whereas men only have two. And they sort of flatline all month for guys. For women, if you were to look at a chart of those hormones, they are all over the place, up and down, up and down. And that's why we never know what kind of a mood we're going to be in when we get up. It's not our fault. There's a Christian comedian, and he says, my wife and I play a little game. It's called Guess What Mood I'm in the morning. Guess what mood she's in. And he says, I have never won that game. So some men may not think that the feminine genius is such a gift, but it is. And there's reasons why we have all these different hormonal strands that are doing different things all month. So we have to be very attentive to how the physical affects the spiritual, how the spiritual affects the physical. Now, we tend to think of genius as something related to the mind, but it really isn't. If you look in the dictionary, it says a natural ability or capacity. Genius is a distinctive character or spirit. So it's really not saying anything much about the mind there. And I always think of the wonderful example of gospel genius when, during the Special Olympics, those Down syndrome kids were running. They were doing the track and field, and all of a sudden, near the finish line, one of the kids tripped and fell. And the others, at the ones who were in the lead, turned around, ran back, picked the kid up, and they all ran over the finish line together. That's genius. That's a form of genius. Now, Pope Benedict said recently, theology can receive a particular contribution from women because they are capable of speaking about God and the mysteries of faith with specific intelligence and sensitivity. And he said, I believe that women themselves, with their energy and strength, with their predominance, so to speak, with what I would call their spiritual power, will know how to make their own space. He was talking about in the church, women in the church. So in a sense, we have to do something ourselves as women. We have to, first of all, get our own act together, get in touch with our nature, and then proceed from there. We can't expect others to do it for us. So what I want to do, before we go too much further talking about the feminine genius, women and theology of the body, we really cannot overlook the feminist movement of the 1960s and 70s. The whole women's liberation movement, which was very much tied into the sexual revolution. Sometimes I ask myself, you know, which came first? Or, you know, how exactly were these linked? And I have a woman, a friend of mine, who was there. She was there at the beginning. She was a hippie. She belonged to a hippie commune and one of the very first. And she's going to explain to us a little bit about what they were trying to do. It's a little different from what you may think. It wasn't simply, let's just cut loose and do whatever we want. No, no, it was, and it was actually very focused on women. So her name is Christina Hayden, and we have her on the line, and we want to ask her some things about what was going on during that time at the beginning of the sexual revolution and the women's movement.
Well, first of all, the commune I grew up with was a Catholic family with 10 children. but I did meet a man who claimed to have been the first hippie. He coined the term.
Wow.
And what was happening at the beginning, from my perspective, was that it was really trying to recover the natural after the post-war industrialization. And look at just the... I think about women's fashion in the 1950s. It was pretty severe. Short hair, Chanel suits, you know, suburban homes, ranch homes, you know, all the conveniences are starting to enter the home. The people, for the most part, left the farms. And I think the hippie movement originally was truly a back-to-nature movement because we've fallen so far away from understanding ourselves as people who were well integrated in the natural world.
Right.
So there was a real
The 50s
sterility.
Were very plastic. There was the sense of plasticity in the 50s.
Yes, and that's when I think plastic was invented.
Right.
So it was really about trying to find out who we were in nature because of that industrialization, that sterility in the architecture and it was manifest in the architecture and so on.
Christine, tell me about the meaning of the word hippie.
Well, the man I talked to, actually, I met him at Kathy Schneider for Life in New Hope, Kentucky. And this was after the community had moved from Sacramento, California. Originally, they had been a hippie commune. And one of the first ones, in fact, I think Timothy Leary came and tried to induce the group into getting into LSD, but they didn't go with him. Their original founding principles were based on marriage for life and everything for the children.
Wow.
A lot of them were reacting to their own parents' divorces and the heartbreak.
Yes.
And they wanted to provide stable home and life for their children.
You told me something about the motto was women and children first.
Well, marriage and children.
Mm-hmm. Who knew that? Who knew that that was actually the underpinnings of some of the hippie movement there? I'm sure the hippie movement split, as you said, like there was Timothy Leary and the whole drug scene.
Right.
But the original pure meaning of the hippies was back to nature and honoring the family and honoring women, right?
Motherhood. Yeah.
Motherhood. And then the pill was introduced in the 1960s. And tell us how that influenced the commune situation.
Well, I think it really it threw a huge wrench in the works because it destroyed a woman's connection with her nature and with nature. Because I just remember what I was drawn to in the hippie movement was the long flowing dresses and the long hair and the natural childbirth and breastfeeding, which my mother had done, was grateful to her. And so just there was sort of an exaltation of women, and it was lovely. But I think that the pill just was an industrialization of woman, really.
Wow, that's an interesting way to put it.
Uh-huh. But the original hippie, his name was Hal Barton, and he told me that he coined the word because he was drawing from the Greek word hippos, meaning horse. And in Greek mythology, the horse was the truth seeker. Mm-hmm. And he told me that every authentic hippie would be a Catholic, and every authentic Catholic would be a hippie.
I love it. That's great.
And his community, after abortion became legal, their commune went on a search of world religions to find out if there was any institution on the face of the earth ever that stood by their founding principles, marriage and children. And lo and behold, the last stone they had to upturn was the Catholic Church.
Hmm.
And then became.
I bet they were surprised at that.
Well, I think
because we can seem
members.
So we can seem so straight laced and square and stuck in the mud and not very, you know, hair flowing and whatever, you know, like the spirit of the free spiritedness of the hippie movement. And yet, if you look at our core principles, they're very similar.
Well, I think any truth seeker is going to find the truth sooner or later. And I was so grateful to recover my faith after some of the involvement in the sexual revolution and become the true hippie that I was inspired to be from the beginning.
And tell us how you got into theology of the body and how you see that as an answer to what people were really searching for. A lot of people were searching, not just the hippies in the 1960s. Everybody was kind of on this search, this quest. And how do you see theology of the body as the answer, the fulfillment to the sexual revolution?
I describe it as a counter-reformation of the sexual revolution. And when I say that, people really, really prick their ears because they want to know if there's any answer. After consenting to a coerced abortion, my biggest question was, why did I do something I didn't want to do? Why did I go passive and had an abortion I didn't want? And I began searching intensely. And I actually was reading the Wednesday audiences as they were being delivered at Through the Wanderer back.
Of Pope John Paul II's Theology of the Body?
Yes.
Yes.
So I saw his, just his recovery of the full dimension of what it means to be human, man and woman, and a remedy, beginning to see a remedy for that very passivity that has been sort of attributed to the feminine as a passive receptivity, or passivity in general, passive matter, those ideas attributed to the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw the just the dignity he was calling women to, but finding within them, you know, originally,
right.
it just sparked me. And
it's really an active receptivity that defines the woman.
Well, it's the feminine. It's the
mm-hmm.
feminine because active receptivity is in both.
Right.
Take a communion.
But of course, our bodies are made a certain way, and in the sexual act, there's a certain order that occurs that we can't, that's not inconsequential. It means something also for the spiritual. It reveals something about the spiritual, right? Well, Christine, we've got to go to a break. Please stay tuned. You are listening to listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
By now, you've heard Father Anthony Bush mention that Winds of Change is listener-supported. What does that mean? It means that you, the listener, keeps Winds of Change on the air. And that is no small task. It takes your donation to pay for our airtime, live streaming, studio equipment, and support staff. With your donation, you help Winds of Change bring you the news that you won't hear on secular media. With your help, we report on the attempts to curtail our religious liberties and give you the resources to respond. We bring you topics and guest hosts that you won't hear on other Catholic radio stations in Chicago, like Byzantine Catholic priest Father Thomas J. Loya, who brings you Blessed John Paul II's teachings on the theology of the body, and Sister Helena Burns' movie reviews and insights on today's new media. Plus, Father Thomas Coys, author of The Ashes That Still Remain, who gives us historical perspective to understand our faith in society today. And every day, you hear our own Father Anthony Bush, author of A Mother's Plea, whose insights on the gospel as applied to our daily life bring perspective as we are buffeted by the winds of change. We need your support now to keep Winds of Change on the air. Here's how to donate. Make a check out to Winds of Change Radio Show. That's Winds of Change Radio Show. And mail it to Winds of Change at 1351 West Evergreen, Chicago, Illinois, 60642. Thank you for listening to and supporting the Winds of Change. And know that by your donation, you help preserve an authentic voice speaking through the winds of change. For some time now, we at Winds of Change have been asking you to support the restoration of St. Stanislaus Kostka, an historic church and great sacred space and home to the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. St. Stan's is also the home of the Our Lady of the Shrine Ark of Mercy iconic monstrance. Because of your help and the help of the Archdiocese of Chicago, we are making progress in restoring this great sacred space. So far, we have outstanding pledges from you for a little over $240,000 and a grant from the Archdiocese of Chicago for $800,000. The complete restoration of St. Stanislaus Kostka will require a total of $4.4 million. You can see that you've helped us make great progress, but we still have a long way to go. We know that it's costing you more just to get to and from work, but we ask you to give what you can. Please help restore this great sacred space where you can come and enter into the silence before the Eucharist in the Our Lady of the Shrine iconic monstrance. Go to thesanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org. That's sanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org. And click on the donate button. Become a part of the continuing story of St. Stanislaus Kostka. And know that with your help, the splendor of this great sacred space will be restored.
Welcome back. I am filling in for Father Anthony Bush. My name is Sister Helena Burns from the Daughters of St. Paul, and you're listening to listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. I had to cut our last guest off a bit quickly, Christine Hayden from Montana. She was one of the original hippies, and she was telling us that to be a hippie is really to be Catholic, and to be Catholic is really to be a hippie, which means being in touch with nature and being in touch with our nature, first of all, as human beings, our feminine nature or our masculine nature, which is, of course, what theology of the body is all about. That's the starting point for theology of the body. It's the body. And we're talking today about women and theology of the body. And we're actually turning back, dialing back a little bit to the sexual revolution and the women's liberation movement of the 60s and 70s. Now, obviously, women needed to be liberated from something. What is this liberation? And basically, it was oppression and abuse at the hands of men, unfortunately, which has been a cultural thing. It's been a historical thing in many cultures, or maybe all, we could say all cultures. And women, especially in the United States, said, you know what? Enough. We want to end this. We want to change this. And so, which was, of course, a great thing. But how did we do that? How did we go about that? Was it really good for women? What are some of the good things we did for women? What are some of the not so good things we did? And my next guest, Jen Giroux, G-I-R-O-U-X. You can check out her fine blog, J-E-N-N-G-I-R-O-U-X.com. She'll correct me if that was wrong. But She's a registered nurse. She is the mother of nine, and she's involved in many, many wonderful ministries to help women understand their true dignity, their true nature. Because, again, we're finding out today that the more women have, the more depressed they seem to be. And I don't mean just materially, but the more women are able to do, the more women seem to, you know, want to have it all and juggle all kinds of things in their lives, the more depressed, it seems, women are getting. And I think it's multifaceted, the reasons for that. But sometimes, again, if we're not living in accord with our nature, our purpose, that's the definition of happiness. If we're trying to sort of thwart something in our nature as women, if we're ignoring something in our nature as women, or just not giving it, not honoring it enough, of course, we're sort of going to frustrate ourselves. And I think what happens in today's society is we see the problem, we see the depression, we see the whatever the outcome is, the symptoms, but we're not necessarily connecting it to where it comes from, because we're thinking where it comes from is actually a good thing for us. So I grew up myself in the 70s, and I knew that we achieved a lot of good things for ourselves. The Women's Liberation Movement did. Women were forced by people were first forced by law to open up job opportunities to women, open up a lot of areas of social life to women. There were sexual harassment laws put in place, many things to help women. But I think one place where we really went off is where we said our fertility is a bad thing. It's our fertility that's keeping us down, tying us down. Motherhood is not such a good thing. Motherhood needs to be shunted to the side, and it's stulting our growth, stultifying our growth. We can't reach our full potential with this motherhood thing in the way. So welcome, Jen, to Winds of Change. Jen has a lot to say, so I'm going to try to really get out of the way and let Jen do a lot of the speaking. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Sister Helena. How are you?
Good. And you?
Very well, and I'm very pleased to be here with you, and I'm very grateful to you for continuing to speak the truth on these matters regarding women, and especially our younger women who are coming up and don't have the memory that those of us that are in our 40s and 50s and 60s have of the way things really should be.
Right.
And that's our challenge, really, is to try and educate our daughters and our granddaughters to make sure they don't repeat the mistakes of the last 50 years.
Yes.
Because truly, women are not being told the truth about the physical or spiritual harms of contraception in every way. So I'm going to dive in really quickly in the interest of time. As a registered nurse, I saw the fallout and the effects on women and families of using birth control. And clearly, in reviewing medical histories for 10 years in my job, I saw that women really no longer valued children anymore. They would react, if I would ask in the medical review, is there a chance you'd be pregnant, they would react so violently. You know, I'll shoot you, I'll kill you, I'll hang myself, I'll shoot my husband. These were all the reactions I would get. And so I came up with this idea, and it's an educational effort I am involved in right now called Speaking of Motherhood, where we visit conferences in high schools and colleges, and I spend about 30 minutes discussing the physical harms of contraception. And then the flip side of that is showing this younger generation the beauty of accepting God's gift of children. So I have four other moms with me that each tell their miraculous stories of saying yes to God and no to the doctors when they were asked to get sterilization and abortions. They trusted God. One woman had 8 C-sections, and that's just almost the subject of a whole other show. But we truly have to show this beautiful flip side of not using birth control, which is all these beautiful little faces. But on the medical side, many women do not realize that most of the birth control out there has been classified as a group 1 carcinogen by the World Health Organization. Now, this is a secular governmental agency that has classified forms of the hormonal contraception in the same category with cigarettes and asbestos. That has nothing to do with Catholic teaching. So when you start with these secular sources I'm talking with, I have found it really opens up a woman's heart to realizing, well, these are undeniable factual things I can look at. It helps them to admit the spiritual effect that using birth control and living a lifestyle they should not be living, which is taking God's gift of sexuality outside of marriage and the harm it's done to them. So let me just run through a few of these statistics. The Mayo Clinic, of course, is a very well-known entity here in the United States as a medical facility. A study was done there confirming that any young girl or woman who is on hormonal birth control for 4 years prior to their first full-term pregnancy increases her breast cancer risk by 52%. Now, they're putting young girls and urging parents in a pediatrician's office to put young girls on the birth control pill as early as 12 years old because of cramps or acne. First of all, irregular periods and cramps, completely normal for young girls. Putting them on the pill does nothing but masks the symptoms and does not address, you know, the healthy development of their cycles. The reason to put them on it for acne is just insufficient evidence that the trade-off is helpful in having them do that. Women who use hormonal birth control for more than 5 years are 4 times more likely to develop cervical cancer. And obviously, you oftentimes hear, especially now from the Obama administration, women need access to this important health care. They are healthier on birth control than they're not having it. Doctors even tell women that they're healthier on birth control.
Isn't that so anti-woman? Isn't that saying that a woman is born abnormal? Like, talk about the Middle Ages. Good Lord, you know, women were super inferior creatures back then, and it was like,
yes.
So it's like,
yep.
There's something wrong with every woman that's born. She needs pills. She has to be fixed. She has to be put on pills so she can actually be healthy, because as a woman, she's not good enough.
Exactly. Never in the history of our country and really in the history of the world have such a huge block of healthy patients put on to a medicine such as this, which is actually causing them further harm. And I want to tell the listeners, if you ever hear somebody on the airway or in person say women are healthier on birth control, a study was done by the Cancer Society, which proved that out of 100 women with cancer today, 31 have breast cancer, 6 have uterine cancer, which is the womb, and 3 have ovarian cancer. So when you hear somebody say, oh, it keeps down uterine cancer, the trade-off, sister, is not worth it. The health risk for putting women at risk for liver and breast cancer is not worth the trade-off. And by the way, there is no documented study anywhere in the Food and Drug Administration that says this is used as a treatment to keep ovarian or uterine cancer down. So it's absolutely true. It's not true that they're healthier, and it's harmful. No one talks about these young girls and women that are laying in the stroke units across this country because of blood clots and strokes and side effects that have happened to them because of being on some form of contraception.
And Jen, you're only talking about the physical repercussions. You're not even talking about the psychological, the spiritual, the societal repercussions of artificial contraception, also as a mentality of contraception. And you know what astounds me too, Jen, is that you never hear anybody talking about natural family planning as an alternative, even in developing countries. You know, we've got to get those pills over there to them. We've got to get those injections. And also, what does not change is the man's behavior. We're not addressing the man's behavior in some of these situations, especially in developing countries where, again, women are not, you know, thought of as sometimes full human beings or whatever. And so everything stays the same and actually gets worse.
I agree with you, sister. And the unfortunate thing is there are efforts to get the word out on natural family planning. Unfortunately, we're up against the big media, who is, as Father Hardin once said, they're in a Luciferian conspiracy against the truth. I thought that was a beautifully put comment about the media. And an interesting thing that I think describes the impact of that this objectification of women can have on women. I talked to an emergency room doctor in the Chicago area when I was up at a talk in Chicago, and he said to me, almost to the person of these young girls, when they come into the emergency room with problems, if they're on some form of the pill or contraception, they're also on an antidepressant. And immediately what hit me is that is where the soul meets the poison chemical in their body, and they're trying to suppress the guilt and the horror they feel about themselves by being objectified. terms of the lifestyle change that we've seen, I believe that people in the 50s and 60s certainly were the first generation that bought into the big lie of go ahead and live together before you get married. Then they, because of that guilt, they didn't want to keep the sex education from their own children. But sister, there's no way anybody could have predicted that today young high school women would be having sexual relations with 20 different people before they're 20. That is how quickly and how rapidly Satan has moved against our children. And it is a widespread problem that is reflected in the statistics of increased sexually transmitted diseases, strokes and heart attacks in young people. And I have to say, from what I've seen in a clinical setting, suicide tendencies for people that loathe themselves from being objectified by so many men.
Yes. Jen, we've got to go to a break. Thank you for all these wonderful statistics. You are listening now to listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750. Stay with us.
The parish of St. Stanislaus Kostka was opened in 1867. As the flow of Polish immigrants poured into the area, a larger church was needed. The cornerstone of that new and present great church was laid in 1877. 20 years later, St. Stan's was the largest parish in the United States, with 8,000 families. This historic church still stands and has been designated by Cardinal George as the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and is also the home of the Our Lady of the Sign Ark of Mercy iconic monstrance. This historic parish still serves the faithful with masses in English, Spanish, and Polish. Now, 134 years later, St. Stan's has begun a project of essential repair and restoration to allow the parish to continue as a beacon of hope for the next generation of Catholics in Chicago. You can become a part of the continuing story of St. Stanislaus Kostka by making a donation now to help in the restoration of this great church. Go to ststanskostka.com. That's ststanskostka.com. Or sanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org. sanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org. And click on the Donate tab on either site. With your help now, the splendor of this great sacred space will be restored. Chances are you didn't realize that there are several different ways that you can contact us here at Winds of Change. You can contact us by email at windsofchangeradio@gmail.com. That's windsofchangeradio@gmail.com. You can like us at facebook.com/windsofchangeshow. That's facebook.com/windsofchangeshow. And follow Winds of Change Show on Twitter. And now back to Father Anthony Bush on the Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Welcome back. My name is Sister Helena Burns from the Daughters of St. Paul, sitting in for Father Anthony on Winds of Change. And I just want to... We keep cutting our guests off because they're so interesting and we don't have time. We don't even say goodbye to them. So what I'm going to do is give you Jen. You just heard from Jen Giroux, who is a registered nurse, mother of nine. I just have to say something about Jen. If you were to meet Jen, you would never guess she's a mother of nine. I mean, what does a mother of nine look like? But this tiny, petite little gal. She is a little spitfire fireball. She's got a 10,000 irons in the fire. And if you go to her blog or her website, Jen Giroux, JenGiroux.com, you'll find all kinds of statistics, the things that she was talking about of how harmful really the pill and artificial contraception is to women, not just physically, but also psychologically. And we're just not making those connections. But little by little, the truth is coming out. Jen has an amazing ministry. I didn't catch the name of it, but she and a bunch of other moms who are just like her, like these gorgeous ladies who go out and they talk to young women about motherhood, the beauty and joys of motherhood. Natural family planning is a way to naturally space out births, and it's 97% effective with a 1% divorce rate in natural family planning couples. So why wouldn't we do that rather than just taking all these pills, which Jen told us are carcinogenics. That's not, the Catholic Church didn't assign, we're not scientists. The Catholic Church is the Catholic Church. But the Mayo Clinic and the World Health Organization classify them as such. But you can find all that information on her blog. I would also like to recommend a fantastic new book that came out called Adam and Eve After the Pill, Paradoxes of the Sexual Revolution by Mary Eberstadt. That's Ignatius Press. And she talks a lot about, again, we were trying to do something good for women. We were trying to help ourselves. We were trying to help women achieve their full potential. But we made some bad choices along the way, and we've got to rectify that. We can't just keep going with this medicating women, acting as though all women must be on the pill. And this is so interesting. Another really wonderful thing to read is Humanae Vitae. That's the Latin name. It was a tiny little document that came out in 1968 from the church about why artificial contraception isn't good from a spiritual point of view and a societal point of view. And again, it's not the Catholic Church. The big lie is that the Catholic Church says have as many babies as you possibly can because we want all those good little Catholics out there, you know. No, it's called responsible parenthood. And if you look in Humanae Vitae, I know that's a little difficult to Google or try to spell. It's also called Of Human Life or On Human Life. You can Google that. And paragraph number 10 talks about responsible parenthood. So here are some of the warnings that Pope Paul VI talked about, and I'll leave it up to you whether you think these have come true in society or not. If the pill and artificial contraception were to be widespread and used everywhere and thought to be an okay thing, first of all, marital infidelity. Second, the general lowering of moral standards. Three, the young will be greatly tempted to use sex in a reckless manner. Four, men will forget the reverence due to women, and disregarding their physical and emotional equilibrium, reduce women to an instrument for the satisfaction of their own desires, no longer considering them as their lifelong partner that they should surround with care and affection. Number five, public authorities will use artificial contraception as a utilitarian problem solver and even force and legislate it on women and couples. And six, public authorities will intervene in the most private and intimate responsibilities of husband and wife. So this is where we are today. And again, we don't want to just talk about all the problems and the negativity. We want to talk about solutions. And theology of the body, the new feminism. If you Google new feminism, you'll find a wonderful Wikipedia entry by a bunch of women that did a fantastic job that will describe what the new feminism is. And I like to be even clearer and call it theology of the body feminism, because there's so many different kinds of feminism out there. And feminism is not a bad thing, depending on what you mean by it. So our next guest is Christine D'Alessio from New Jersey. I met her at the Theology of the Body Institute, and she even has a blog, and I hope I'm going to get this right. She can correct me, but sure. It's called Feminism, the Catholic F Word. Is that right?
That's right. It's at CatholicFWord.com.
Okay. So Christine is married, and she is a youth minister. And I would love for her to talk about how she got into new feminism, theology of the body feminism, and how she sees that as the true feminism.
Great. I first of all just want to say thank you so much, sister, for inviting me to speak about something that's so dear to my heart. Of course, growing up, like many of us, I felt that there was more out there to womanhood than what I could see. And in the last several years, since discovering the theology of the body for myself, I actually found out that I was right. There is more. And what I didn't know was that back in the 1960s, at the end of the Second Vatican Council, that Paul VI was telling us the same thing. He was the one who said that the hour has come when the vocation of women is being acknowledged in its fullness, the hour in which women acquire in the world an influence, an effect, and a power never hitherto achieved. And those are such empowering words. And really what the new feminism seeks to do is to find that particular genius of women, that particular beauty that John Paul II talks about, that enables us to know not only where we came from, but where the human person really stands, and give a voice to our contribution to humanity as women. John Paul II said in his Theology of the Body also this, that woman finds herself in her own gift of self when she has been accepted in the way in which the Creator wills her, namely for her own sake, through her humanity and femininity. And some of the studies I've done on the theology of the body really reflect this idea that woman is created as a person for her own sake, that we have something special about us as women, and that in our own femininity, we give a gift to the men of the world and to the entire human race because we reflect the image of God in a particular way in our femininity, in our humanity.
Do you think that when women in the 60s and 70s started to, you know, really come into their own and, in a sense, sometimes even, like, broke away from men to try to, like, regroup among ourselves, but we didn't have any models? I know that sounds strange, but, for example, most of history was written by men, et cetera, et cetera. And so we didn't really know where to look. I mean, we have the Blessed Mother, et cetera, but it's always like, well, how does that play out? And would you agree with me that, so what women did, unfortunately, and I don't even think they realized they were doing this, the feminists looked at men and said, we can do that. We can be like men. We can be better men than the men. And they adopted a male paradigm. Instead of looking within and maybe stumbling and bumbling at first to find our true voice and our true femininity, do you think that women, unfortunately, just imitated men?
Yes, I think they did. I think you're absolutely right. We didn't really have a paradigm for what it meant to be feminine in the true sense of the word, not something that was just sort of a pretty external ideal, but feminine in the sense of all the great contributions that the feminine heart and that womanhood and woman with her intellect and her intuition can contribute. And so I think what happened was, for lack of a better model, women started to try to imitate the very thing which they resented, which was a structure that was based on dominance. Mm. And that is not what we're called to in the theology of the body. We're called to collaboration between men and women, one made for the other.
Yes, that's beautiful. I mean, the word for, that little word for, is so important, isn't it, in theology of the body, that women are for men and men are for women and we work together. It's about interdependence, not dependence, but interdependence.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I love about the way John Paul II teaches this particular call to women came in a letter years ago to Marianne Glendon when she said to him, you know, Holy Father, how would you have us be? What do you want to see from women? And he kind of smiled at her and said, well, that's up to you to find out.
Absolutely.
Because as a man, he recognized, it's not for me. This has to come from the heart of woman because the Holy Spirit works in the heart of woman in a particular way.
Right. We have to do this for ourselves. And even the best men like Christopher West and John Paul II and Benedict, they keep throwing it back at us saying, we can only go so far, you know, observing you and knowing theology, knowing philosophy, knowing anthropology, but it's got to come from within. And I think they've done a great job, John Paul II, et cetera. I'm just going to read this from John Paul II's letter on the dignity and vocation of women. And he said, the feminine genius includes being mothers, number one, caregivers, as well as participation in politics and economics. And the feminine genius includes empathy, interpersonal relations, emotive capacity, communication, intuition, and personalization. And wow, are those important aspects? Aren't they? I mean, but sometimes we devalue them because, like you said, male power, we want this power, but the male type of power, this other stuff, that's female power, you know? If you've noticed, and I've noticed in two movies recently, Tangled and Snow White and the Huntsman, where women, the women there didn't just, you know, take spears and swords and try to kill everybody. They befriended the monsters. They tamed the monster. I mean, we have our own way of doing everything, you know?
Absolutely.
And we have to get in touch with that.
I say that women have a particular empathy for the human person because we can see the heart in a way that men cannot.
Yes.
But that's part of the genius of who a woman is.
Yes. And we're entrusted, he said, with the new person in a special way. Obviously, we carry babies in our bodies, in our wombs.
That's
and
right.
So God has entrusted, what an honor, has entrusted the new person to us. And so women instinctively see the whole person. We don't just see
Absolutely.
Body parts or functionalities. We see an entire person when we see a baby in front of us or a man or another woman or a child. Tell us about your work with youth, because you are seeing this new generation of young women. What do you feel their needs are? How can we help them?
Well, I've been working with teenagers and young adults just after college age and also college-age women at, say, Rutgers University in Seton Hall for about the last 8 years. It's a very different generation, and really at the heart of the matter is that they just do not know who they are. They tend to be more less thoughtful about who they are as women and more hopeless in what they can and who they can be. Their achievements are limitless. So, you know, certainly our 60s sister feminists who were trying so hard but maybe didn't get it all right were right in that, you know, finally women can be doctors and lawyers and follow their gifts and their skills that God gave them. But I think that there's just a hunger to know who I really am as a girl, as a woman, and why does it make a difference? There's a frustration with men, but not a real understanding that there's a difference and that that difference doesn't always have to be a bad thing.
Right. Thank you so much, Christine. I wish we had 3 more hours because
absolutely.
I know you've been doing so much research and you're in the trenches there, you know, daily. So thank you so much and God bless your work.
Thank you, sister.
And tell us the name of your blog again.
It's CatholicFWord.com. It's feminism, the Catholic F word.
I love it. Thanks, Christine. You are listening to Winds of Change. I am sitting in for Father Anthony Bush at AM 750. Stay with us.
By now, you've heard Father Anthony Bush mention that Winds of Change is listener-supported. What does that mean? It means that you, the listener, keeps Winds of Change on the air. And that is no small task. It takes your donation to pay for our airtime, live streaming, studio equipment, and support staff. With your donation, you help Winds of Change bring you the news that you won't hear on secular media. With your help, we report on the attempts to curtail our religious liberties and give you the resources to respond. We bring you topics and guest hosts that you won't hear on other Catholic radio stations in Chicago, like Byzantine Catholic priest Father Thomas J. Loya, who brings you Blessed John Paul II's teachings on the theology of the body, and Sister Helena Burns' movie reviews and insights on today's new media. Plus, Father Thomas Coyes, author of The Ashes That Still Remain, who gives us historical perspective to understand our faith in society today. And every day, you hear our own Father Anthony Bush, author of A Mother's Plea, whose insights on the gospel as applied to our daily life bring perspective as we are buffeted by the winds of change. We need your support now to keep Winds of Change on the air. Here's how to donate. Make a check out to Winds of Change Radio Show. That's Winds of Change Radio Show. And mail it to Winds of Change at 1351 West Evergreen, Chicago, Illinois, 60642. Thank you for listening to and supporting the Winds of Change. And know that by your donation, you help preserve an authentic voice speaking through the Winds of Change. The parish of St. Stanislaus Kostka was opened in 1867. As the flow of Polish immigrants poured into the area, a larger church was needed. The cornerstone of that new and present great church was laid in 1877. 20 years later, St. Stan's was the largest parish in the United States, with 8,000 families. This historic church still stands and has been designated by Cardinal George as the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and is also the home of the Our Lady of the Sign Ark of Mercy iconic monstrance. This historic parish still serves the faithful with masses in English, Spanish, and Polish. Now, 134 years later, St. Stan's has begun a project of essential repair and restoration to allow the parish to continue as a beacon of hope for the next generation of Catholics in Chicago. You can become a part of the continuing story of St. Stanislaus Kostka by making a donation now to help in the restoration of this great church. Go to ststanskostka.com. That's ststanskostka.com or sanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org. sanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org, and click on the Donate tab on either site. With your help now, the splendor of this great sacred space will be restored.
Welcome back to Winds of Change. My name is Sister Helena Burns from the Daughters of St. Paul, and I am sitting in for Father Anthony Bush here at 7:50 a.m. And my next guest, we're not able to contact her, but we're going to keep trying. I will fill in for her. We're talking today about theology of the body and women, about the feminine genius, what women really need today, what is true femininity, and how do we live that? And this last section of our show today, we wanted to talk about women's fantasy lives, especially just touching on that phenomenon of the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy, where women are sort of indulging in these what's called women's porn, even though it's just narrative, it's text. But trashy novels have always been women's porn. Why? Well, women are not as visually stimulated as men are. Although many more women today are getting addicted to porn, as men are, but we emphasize the romantic, we emphasize the emotional, we like the dialogue, we like the drama, we like the whole story, relational part of the romance thing. And so, as you know, so many women are getting into these books as though, you know, there's nothing harmful about that. Young women, too. And so what's going on there? Well, all of us have this natural need, this natural, our sexual urges or whatever. So certainly it's filling that. But my next guest, if we get her or not, no, we're not getting her. Okay. I'm going to tell you what she says. She is a sex addiction counselor, and she has a wonderful program that she's developing, which is taking the 12 steps of sexual addiction, because they use the all addicts, you know, use the 12 steps. And she combines that with theology of the body principles. And she was helped to do this by a wonderful, wonderful psychologist in New York City named Dr. Phil Mango, just like the fruit, M-A-N-G-O. He is fabulous. You can Google him. He uses theology of the body in his practice as well. He has a fascinating story. He was a NYPD. He's also a jazz musician and a psychologist. So he's a fascinating guy, very well-rounded. And he is helping her to start this program. It's not just for women, but what she's calling it is seeing one another rightly. Seeing one another rightly. S-O-A-R, SOAR, 0136 at AOL.com. So if you want to contact my friend Bernadette, her email is SOAR, S-O-A-R, 0136 at AOL.com. It's totally confidential. And she called me recently and said, I'm so concerned about this phenomenon of the 50 Shades of Grey erotica stuff because it's really, really damaging to women. Our fantasy lives are just, our imaginations are just so overstimulated. And it starts to dribble into real life. It starts to kind of encroach on our waking hours. And it starts to give us some very unrealistic expectations about our own relationships in real life. Now, here's the very interesting thing. People love to say that Jesus said very little about sexuality. So in other words, Jesus doesn't care what we do with our bodies. Have you heard that one? I've heard that many times. Now, how is that possible? That Jesus doesn't care what we do. God doesn't care what we do with our bodies. He made us. We're one person, body and soul. So it's not like our souls can be doing one thing while our bodies are doing another. No. Whatever we do with our soul, we do with our body. Whatever we do with our body, we do with our soul, because we're one person. We cannot separate the two. It's much more than just a soul-body connection. It's one thing. It's one unit. So what I like to say is, yeah, that's true. Jesus said very little about sexuality. But you have to also remember that back in his day, there was no split. There was no body-soul split. People understood that they were one thing. So that being that as it may. But Jesus was very clear about our interior lives. He said, if a man looks lustfully at a woman, he has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Wow. If a man looks lustfully at a woman, he has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Wow. He was saying that our interior actions are real. For good also, for good or for bad. We can have good intentions toward others or not so good intentions. But they're real actions. Our behaviors, our internal behaviors are real. And of course, they impact our whole selves. So what I like to say is, yep, what Jesus said about sex, he said very little. But what he said was so revolutionary that we've chosen just to ignore it. we go right over those parts of the scriptures. And actually, he said more, you know, about our interior lives. He said things like, you know, if you hold your brother in contempt, you risk the fires of Gehenna. In other words, if you're just harboring this in your heart, you haven't done anything to the person. You haven't, you know, done anything bad to them, but you're harboring some evil inside of you towards this person. That's not good. And Jesus also said, from within comes evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. So, you know, in Jesus' day, there was a great emphasis on the external. People thought, oh, I'll punch my religious time card and I'll be fine. I'll show up at the synagogue and do all my little practices and rituals and I'm fine. And he's saying, no, 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 no. It's the other way around. Religion should proceed from the inside. We need to be clean and pure on the inside, you know? So unfortunately today, we are so external about everything. It's about being seen. It's about being heard. It's about our appearance, which is fine, but it can't be only about that. That the emphasis can't be on that. The emphasis has to be on what's going on inside. So we really need to focus on that and ask ourselves, what's going on when we're reading these trashy romance novels? There can be sin involved just in the reading of it. You know, wow, what do you mean? Well, Jesus said it, not me, about looking lustfully at someone is already committing adultery with them. Now, what did he mean by adultery? What if it's two single people? How can they be committing adultery? What if a single man looks at a single woman lustfully, or a single woman looks at a single man lustfully? Why would it be adultery? Ah, this is a great question. This is what Scott Hahn calls the holy huh. If you read something in the Bible and you're like, what the heck does that mean? There's probably a really amazing answer to it. And there is. We are, first of all, in a spousal relationship with God. God is the lover of our soul and our body. God is our spouse. We know that there's many, many instances in Scripture, Old Testament as well, calling God our husband, calling God our spouse. And so, first of all, we're in this relationship with God, this very intimate relationship with God. And so, as St. Paul says, the body is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body, the human body. Our bodies are in relationship with Him. So, women, if they're not getting their sort of emotional needs met in real life, they will kind of go to the media. They'll kind of go to these fantasy lives. And women, we have to be very careful about this. Also because sometimes we can be a little demanding, you know. We think we're entitled to have this amazing 24/7 emotional experience. You know what? No, life isn't like that. Life isn't just a series of highs. So we've got to realize that we don't need to follow through on every emotional impulse that we have. I read a wonderful blog post by a woman who said, she's actually calls herself a recovering lesbian. You can find, if you Google it, you can find it, Confessions of a Recovering Lesbian. And she said, you know, I will shut down emotionally and physically if I have to, so that I don't cause him, Jesus, any more pain, him who suffered so much for me, so I don't have to follow through on all my emotional impulses. Well, we are kind of getting near toward the end of our time together, and I want to just give some more resources that you can check out in regard to theology of the body and women. There's a wonderful book called Women, Sex, and the Church, A Case for Catholic Teaching. It's a compilation of women scholars, but it's very, very readable. You can find it at Pauline.org. We are out of time. Please join us next time at Winds of Change. My name is Sister Helena Burns from Daughters of St. Paul, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush at Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.